Susan Montanaro, and you're listening to Dreams and Detours, a show about the life we plan to have versus the one we're living, for better or not. Everybody has a story, and I believe we find ourselves in each other's stories. Hi, and welcome to Dreams and Detours. Today, I want to welcome to the show Daniel Joshua Rubin, a profound writer across a variety of mediums, including TV, theater, advertising, plus. Daniel's a storyteller, and he's written and collaborated with award-winning artists all around the world. Welcome to the show, Daniel.
Hi.
So happy to have you.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So, you and I have a mutual friend. You brought us together for the awesome opportunity to record and to put your story out there. I'm so excited about that. Let's just start with, you know, who are you? So tell me a little bit about where you grew up and what that was like.
Sure. I grew up in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn. Our apartment overlooked the Atlantic Ocean, overlooked Coney Island. Really colorful neighborhood.
Wow.
Very, very super Jewy. My building was called Brightwater Towers, but we grew up in Trump Village.
Wow.
Fred C. Trump, Donald's dad, built all these 23-story high rises, and we just used to play in those schoolyards. That was my...
How's that for coming full circle in the Trump world today?
it is pretty shocking, I gotta say. I
mean, that's amazing. And so growing up in that section of Brooklyn, you obviously had tons of culture and influence. Tell me a little bit about your family life. What did your parents do for a living?
Sure.
Siblings and such?
Absolutely. My dad was a pharmacist who had an interesting story. He grew up in a pharmacy that his dad started, and he hated it. He hated being there. It stressed him out. He wasn't meant for retail. And he actually went to law school when he was like 40, and he became a lawyer, became a malpractice lawyer who defended hospitals and doctors. And my mom was a teacher in the local public school. So they had a horrible, I don't know if I'm supposed to say that, but not a great marriage. But
okay.
they would each agree with that.
Okay, fair enough.
And then she actually... left him. This is funny. I don't know if I should talk about this. But yeah, they got divorced. And my mom was meant to be in like the country and live in like, she wanted dogs and live in a beautiful rural environment. And she married our local shoe man. Sadly, he actually just passed away a couple of days ago. I just got back from New England.
Sorry to hear it.
Was sorry. But so anyway, but they... very colorful characters, if that.
Yeah. So, late, but tell me how that influenced you, though, because growing up, first of all, in a very colorful neighborhood, certainly that has an impact on you. But then you're in a home where dad's not happy and reinvents himself. Mom is not happy with just her life and her surroundings. And, of course, the marriage wasn't working out for her. So how did that impact you and such?
I was kind of a mama's boy. Like, I think I learned a tremendous amount of not to do in a marriage. I mean, they would go at it quite a bit. They had very different ideas of how a house should be. I talked about my dad being a colorful character. Not the greatest manners. My mom is very refined. My mom likes quiet. She likes birds. She likes classical music playing. And my dad's more, he has sports blasting. He has the New York Times all over the place. And he's
it's almost like, how did they pair, right?
Well, my mom taught me a really, really vital point, whereas she felt she was really into the idea that she could just sand off his rough edges, she would say. And his attitude was like, I don't need any rough edges. I call him a Popeye-ist. Meaning I am what I am. He is what he is, and he was never going to change. And I don't know. I really feel thankful that I was ever born, because it really shouldn't have happened.
So interesting, right?
Yeah, so they were really, really at odds and not a perfect match, I think, by their own means. But luckily, they actually met people who were much better suited for them. And they were great. They were a great divorce couple because they say colorful things about each other, but not really like sadistic or
cutting. Right.
And they didn't want us to grow up hating either one of the parents. So
right.
My mom moved to Bay Ridge, different part of Brooklyn, with a very refined guy. And my dad moved in with someone who appreciated his great intellect. Mm-hmm. And his new wife greatly appreciates his other qualities.
Yeah, of course. So, but it sounds like, you know, that it was like they could be the way they are now because yes. they were able to leave one another and find their bliss.
Right, absolutely. And I do think it taught me a tremendous amount about right. marriage and about I'm happily married I'm with my wife now 30 years.
Yeah.
So I do think watching How Not to Do It mm-hmm. was extremely helpful in...
Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have one brother.
Okay, yeah. So hopefully he has learned some of that as well.
I think he has.
Good, that's awesome, that's very good. So growing up, dad's working in the pharmacy until he gets to law school, mom's an educator. Uh-huh. Do you think that her influence had something to do with your desire to write? Was that even something that, as at a young age, that you knew much about?
Yeah, my mom, it's funny, my mom was an English teacher, was a teacher in grade school. And she kind of came from this school of thought that must have been prevalent in the 60s and 70s, where don't overload Junior with like grammar and rules, let his creativity run free. And I do think my mom thought I was kind of incredibly special. And she just whatever I drew, whatever I wrote seemed to be and I had a really foul mouth as a child. That was sort of my thing in the neighborhood. I had a big fat head, which I still do, but it was like really big when I was little. And I was known in the neighborhood in Little League and as the kid with the foul mouth.
Like that's that was hilarious.
It was really funny. And by today's standards, I would be probably suspended from school and thrown out of society.
Right, right.
Things we said back then were horrible, but they were funny. And like, I don't know if you remember the Bad News Bears.
Of course.
Like, we thought that was the greatest thing in the world, where the kids drink beers and they curse. And my Little League was just like that. Our Little League was filled with colorful characters and violent fights and coaches and cursing. So anyway, I used to write. I used to, like, in school, I would say, I have things from my camp letters in school that would say, like, I want to grow up to be a Playboy photographer. And with pictures of naked women, I was, like, in second grade.
So oh my God.
I was very colorful, and my mom always thought that stuff was hilarious.
Right.
So I wrote a book of fables when I was in like fifth grade. No, really young. I don't know how young, but it's like I thought Aesop's Fables was the greatest thing.
Right.
Should I tell you why? Is that interesting?
Go for it. Yeah, absolutely.
I really remember one time in school getting bullied a little bit, and I was a scrappy little fella, but I remember trying to reason my way out of it. And then I remember reading an Aesop's fable about this wolf that wants to eat a lamb. And the wolf keeps saying, you know, you did this terrible thing to me. And the lamb is like, there's no way that could happen. I was born like a month ago. And anyway, so the wolf eventually eats the lamb. And the moral is, you can't reason with some people.
Right.
And I just remember thinking like, oh my God, that was the greatest story ever written, because it really is teaching me how to live. So I really wanted to write ever since I was in like fifth grade, and it seemed to be I sucked at math and science.
Right.
I literally, one time my mother got called up to school because on a test it said, name the angles, and on a math test, and it said, you know, like obtuse, acute, but I had no idea what any of that crap meant. I named them like Larry, John, Billy.
No, you didn't.
She thought I was being a wise ass, Mr. Wow. Garfunkel. And my mom came up to school and got in a fight with him because she was like, you're not appreciating Daniel's creativity.
Right.
And anyway, he was like, well, Daniel's not supposed to be creative. This is math. So anyway, so
that I was a fantastic
bastard, just so you know.
I just want you to know, I failed math 3 times in college, and it actually prevented me from graduating, and I had to go an extra year just for 3 lousy credits. So I am with you on that.
Some of us just... And I got to say, I have calculators and I've never had a problem. And never had to do algebra yet.
Not yet. Me neither. Yeah. I think we're safe. I think we're good to go. So that's really cool. The fact that you already knew that you wanted to be a writer. And then, you know, fast forward, you go to college, you're studying. And then in your undergraduate, did you actually take all sorts of classes for creative writing? Or was that your degree? What were you doing in the undergrad?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I went, this is kind of a little detour in college. I went to SUNY Stony Brook, State University of New York at Stony Brook for people that are the SUNYs. And I went to Stony Brook, and Stony Brook was a madhouse. It was Long Island. There was fighting. We had so many crazy incidents. I can't even believe it. Like a student had a baby in the basement and the FBI came and just so many fights. And I realized this is not going to work for me.
Wow. Yeah.
Literally the jokes on me in my dorm room were like that I was a theater major, and it was like, this is not going to work. So I transferred to State University of New York at Purchase, which is that's how I met the guy who introduced us.
Right, our friend.
Great and famous graphic designer.
That's right.
And then I really found myself there where it was just such a great school. Everyone was artists. Everyone was super cool. I mean, I really love that place. There was a ballet program. There was a theater program, an acting, a film. And I took drama studies and I wrote, produced, and directed like three of my own plays.
So you were really in your element.
Absolutely. 100%. So getting out of the wrong place and going to the right place was a big deal for me.
That's fantastic.
And I learned a ton about how to do it just by doing it. And it's funny because back then I used to complain, you know, you guys don't support us enough. And they were like, shut up, just do the work and you'll learn from doing it. And in hindsight, I would like to go back to that school and apologize to everyone and tell them that but just do it is a great way to go.
That's fantastic. So yeah. I know a little bit about you just because, you know, I know who you are. Did your decision to go to like your upper level at Yale, was that like a decision you made right away? Or was that not something that you felt confident doing? Or how'd you end up there?
To go to Yale.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's really funny. This was one of those things where like for me, my dad was very involved in like, if you don't get the best thing, very, very kind of elitist, for lack of a better term. So he just told me that you have to go to Yale. Like it was like it had to happen.
Like if you're going to do it, you should do it like at its absolute highest level. Okay.
Yes. It's really funny, actually. Quick thing. Like for my bar mitzvah, we were not religious, but my dad said, if you're going to have a bar mitzvah and you're going to make me do this because all your friends have bar mitzvahs, you have to have a full Orthodox.
Oh my gosh.
So I had the tefillin wrapped around my head and I had to go to Hebrew school massively because I want every kid in my neighborhood a bar mitzvah. So anyway, that was this extremist kind of ideology my dad had. And to his credit, he got me into an internship program at Williamstown, which is a famous theater, summer theater. And I actually, my best friend, I'm name dropping, which is kind of gross, but my best friend that summer was another kid named Pete Dinklage, who, was a even shorter than I was. And we just had so much fun that year and played a big role. That and my work at Purchase got me into Yale. It was kind of a big break. But I just, to be honest, when I look back on it, some of it was a little bit questionable in that just because it's the highest rated school doesn't necessarily mean it's the best school for you.
Sure. Like,
yeah, I mean, there's plenty of great schools and great teachers. And so I had a very mixed experience at Yale.
Okay. But it got you somewhere. So then post Yale, you made your way into your craft and into your career and your profession. And what led you to want to write for TV or get into the whole world of, you know, producing content for that level of consumption?
I'm probably going to be too honest here, but I went from Yale to my wife's from Chicago and I came out here and I am here now. I loved Chicago. I just thought it was a great town.
Great city,
Very close, young director in Chicago. And she directed three of my plays in Chicago. So I was a total playwright. I always thought just theater was the way to go. And the first play I ever saw was by David Mamet. It was Glengarry Glen Ross.
Nice.
There was a famous scene where Joe Montana is yelling at everybody. And he says, at one point he stops and he goes, fuck this, fuck that, and fuck you. And I went, wow, you can say that stuff.
I like this.
So I literally went out to Chicago to be like a young Mamet I wanted to be. And I wrote these plays. They got directed. But then, to be honest, one of the big, I think, life mistakes I ever made. This was I mean, who knows if it's all a mistake. I mean, that's what, I guess, the essence of what we're talking about. But I got to Steppenwolf, which is like the big theater in Chicago. And my friend Anna, who actually is now the artistic director of Steppenwolf, that young director I just talked about a minute ago, but she directed my play. And the play I wrote was a really controversial play for the moment. It was an idea where the prison system was so overcrowded, you had to adopt a prisoner. Instead of go to the army, you adopt a prisoner and then you're responsible for him. And it was about a white couple with a black guy in a cage in their living room. So that got done, and I don't think I had back then, I was like 30 years old, I don't think I had the chutzpah and the toughness to weather the feedback coming at me. And people were emotional.
It's been controversial for sure, yeah.
Calling me racist and all kinds of things. And the play got mixed reviews. Like one critic loved it, and one critic, oh my God, he whipped my ass. And I just felt like I got so mad. I had like a temper tantrum. Like, if they don't appreciate me in Chicago, fuck them. I'm going to LA, which was beyond ludicrous. Like, I look back and I think, oh my God, dude, you were 30, playwright in Steppenwolf. That's an amazing thing. But right. I didn't appreciate any of it. I think going to Yale at a young age made me feel like the world was just waiting for my genius to gift it. And that's just not how life really actually works. So in the kind of a huff, I went to LA. That was how I left theater and went to LA. And that was in hindsight, a catastrophically awful decision for my career, even though I had an okay career in LA.
Right. And so you spent time out there. You did a lot of great work, obviously. Made a lot of great connections and relationships, clearly, and grew. I mean, that's what it seems like to me. You grew as an artist. Right. And how did that work for you, though? Like, how long did you stay? And like, when did you leave? And why did you leave? And why walk away from it all?
I went out to LA, and right away I got a really great agent. She was at William Morris, very well respected. It's funny, I'm thinking of a little theme here, but like, I had a smaller agency that was real excited about working with me. And in hindsight, I think that probably would have been a better fit for me. I like small, scrappy, independent, but I was with big William Morris and I thought I was just the biggest thing in the world. And I got on a TV show right away, and I met some great writers, but I thought once you got on a TV show, you're automatically successful and you get like a lifetime membership to the club. And that is not how it works. Like, the show got canceled after like 3 months. I really believe my show might have been one of the lowest rated shows. It was great to write for a TV show and really met some unbelievable writers. Like, guys, you realize like, wow, this is the big leagues. Like, some of those guys in that room are the funniest people like you could imagine. And I thought I was a funny guy, but these guys are really funny.
Not so a bad thing to rub elbows with people like that, though, you know?
Right. But I also, for me, I had just had a daughter, and I really wanted to spend more time with my kid and my wife than like work 24/7, network like a maniac, hustle and play people. And I hope I don't come off as too bitter, but like, LA is really about networking and hustling and selling your mother down the river if need be to get the gig. And it's really not my nature. I mean, I hope I'm not being wimpy and letting myself off the hook, but it's a cutthroat, savage place.
You need to be built for stuff like that. And I think I look at it like this. You could either be 100% that, so right. Go for it.
Right.
Or, like I often say, we sort of have those moments maybe earlier in our career when we're just trying to like get our chops into something and figure it out and feel it out and see if that's indeed, like you did, you know, is that all it is? Is that every bit of like, you know, the dream of where I think I want to land? And you learn very quickly, it sounds like, that, you know, not landing in TV doesn't necessarily bring it all, you know? And so you had to become something else, and over time clearly didn't enjoy what that meant. So that's cool.
But if talking about big detours, my gigantic, massive, life-changing detour came when, after 9/11 happened, and that I was so stressed out about that. I realized that I had to put aside my professional aspirations to just work on my own crap. And I found a martial arts school, and I'm not at all one of these guys who wants to pretend I'm so much tougher. Much about like personal development and finding your tribe and your community. And I just found the greatest guys in the world. Just unbelievably tough, cool, smart, really interested in living a more dignified life. And so I put a tremendous amount into getting up the ranks, they call it, you know. So
was this when you were still out in LA?
Yeah, so I'm still in LA then. Mm-hmm. And I just worked on, like, personal development was a huge part of my shtick for that time to get. I'm scrappy and I don't take kindly to insults. And maybe nobody does. But in LA, you really have to be suave about fielding negative energy because mm-hmm. people are hyper competitive.
Sure.
Comedy writers are unbelievably vicious. When you're in a writing room and you're doing comedy, it's, if you have a pimple, if you got a ugly shirt on, if you're bald headed and people are not in the mood to look at a bald head, you're going to hear about it. And you're going to hear about it with extreme aggression. And it gets very confusing. So navigating the hostilities of LA was really a challenge. But the martial art thing was incredibly helpful. But it got to a point where I decided, why am I doing this? Should I tell you about the time how I left LA?
Absolutely.
All over the place. So, so I got a job on a TV show, and it was a long, brutal battle to get that gig. It was levels of meanness in the writing room that you just almost couldn't believe what you're seeing. But if you wanted to figure out how many different people didn't like each other and you were constantly feeling like, if I talk to him, he's going to be mad at me. If I sit with her, so navigating all
Survivor.
That was...
It was like Survivor.
totally like Survivor. I saw people insult people and people got fired in public and these were really successful writers, like guys who went on and women who went on to do really great, really big things. But I just realized, like, this is not how I want to spend my life at all. And I just quit the whole thing. And my wife and I used to come home for the holidays for Chicago. And I'm a humongous Chicago fan. I just feel like there is something here. I don't know if it's in the air or what it is. I mean, obviously we're not perfect. It's just the nicest place in the world. Just people are just, there's just a kindness here and responded very well to. And I came back and just changed careers completely when I came back. So,
blew up LA, got the heck out of Dodge, went back home to really what home feels like, and that's in Chicago. And you hung up your writing.
So what I did is I got a job working for an agricultural risk management company, and my friend ran the company. So he's a great guy, real straight shooter. And this company is just nice people. Just the atmosphere at this company was what you see is what you get. There's not a lot, there's no infighting, no double talking. And it was a funny
polar
thing
opposite,
because in Hollywood,
basically.
It was a jarring thing because in LA, the people probably share more of my politics. I'm sort of a middle of the road Democrat kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And this was much more of a right leaning company, very Republican. And these guys are the greatest guys in the world. So we helped farmers manage their risk using futures and options. I won't bore everyone with too many details of that, but I got to travel the heartland and the red states.
Your friend gets you the gig, not to interrupt, yes. Your friend gets you the gig. And so that actually ended up being, I'm sure, you know, with a family in tow, you know, you want to do all the right things. You want to be seamlessly working again and such. Uh-huh. You don't return to Steppenwolf. You don't return to some of the places and people that you necessarily knew, but you take this real detour into this other kind of environment and industry. And I just think that's so cool that you did it. But I have to ask, even though you're with really nice and normal people, which I'm sure was so needed at that point in time for you, just to like reaffirm goodness, right? But how'd you feel not being in this like writing role, not using that part of your artistic self? Or did you think that you were in the position you had?
No, I was pretty damaged in some ways where I'm like, I went through this phase where I thought, holy shit, like the funny thing about the job I had was I actually spent a lot of time studying how to be like a good executive and how to be a productive worker. And the job was actually really easy. Farmers don't respond well to things that look slick. So I literally went to community college and I learned how to use like Photoshop and Illustrator. And my job was so easy. And I literally would say like, attention cattlemen. And then I would explain things to them about how we worked. And they were very comfortable letting me repeat. There was like three ways you could say things. It just was the truth of what we offered. So as long as I kept the trains rolling on time, my bosses were happy. And I was definitely went through a period where I was like, wow, this is how my life has ended up. I'm a agricultural risk management marketing guy. And from a money standpoint, it was like amazing because I'd never had a regular paycheck. I always made money 6 months, didn't make money 6 months. And wow. Bizarre, you know, it was just a hustle kind of lifestyle.
Right.
But every week when we had this one of the women who come through payroll and drop your check off, I was like, this is unbelievable. Like, really save money making. I could like go out for nice dinners. And the great thing about it that was so cool was at 4 o'clock, your day ended. You know, you're done. You have done your job. The boss doesn't want you there. He wanted you with your family. But with writing and art, you just always feel like you're not Shakespeare. You're not fucking Quentin Tarantino. You got to keep hustling. You're always feeling like wanting and stressed out. And this was amazing. Like you'd go to the train or you'd go out for a beer with your buddies and you'd be like, I'm free.
Like everything's good.
And that was awesome. Like that was an amazing feeling. And for me, the big thing was, I think because I had success at a young age, I really think I got really arrogant and I didn't appreciate people who just work hard for a living. And my attitude was that, like, if you're not a writer or an artist or an actor, you're not going places, part of me felt like you're not shit. I don't need to waste my time with you. But my coworkers at this company were my favorite people in the world. Like, I love being with these guys. And let me tell you, actually, these guys were more quirky than I made it sound original. They're funny guys. A lot of these guys, I think, were funnier than guys I met in LA.
I bet. And
so, but I do remember like a huge moment in my life where it was brutally cold Chicago winter. And I was walking to work in the rain and driving like ice and feeling like I was nothing. Like just, I had failed in every way a human being could fail. I was supposed to be this Yale big shot. I have friends, you know, I dropped a few names. I brought Dinklage. My friend Anna's a big Tony Award winning director. I have other friends from school who became huge stars. And I just felt like, God, I suck. Like I have fucked this whole thing up. But I do remember on this day walking to work and feeling like, hold on a second. Let's just say it's true that you failed miserably and you're nothing. I was like, there's a lot of freedom in this. Like no one's bothering me. I don't have agents, lawyers, networking to do. There's no pressure. No one's calling me up saying, did you finish that script? I just was a guy with a job. But then I do remember having this really profound moment where I got to work and it was really bad weather. And I got to work early. We started work at like 7:30 and I see people, I'm at my desk and I'm watching my friends come in and they got sick children and sick parents and flooding in the basement and a wind tore off the roof and they're just busting their ass. And I had the greatest moment where I thought, who the fuck am I to think, because I was a writer, I'm better than these people? Like, because I had the little card that got me on the lot that let me go park my car next to a celebrity. And then I had I think one of the best moments of my life where I decided, all right, I'm over, this sounds so corny what I'm about to say, but I said, now that I quit being a writer, I can write. Like now I could just write whatever the
pressure's off.
Right, yeah. All the pressure's off. I could do whatever I want as long as I'm a good boy and go to my job. I started writing a play, and then I started thinking a lot about my dream life would be to build a little writing studio, teach writing at night, and I didn't want to work for college. I don't like bureaucracy. I don't like how expensive college is. I thought I could teach you so many great things about writing in a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. So I actually started keeping a journal of basic principles for teaching writing. My job, which was so strange about, talk about detours. I'm jumping around a bit, but I think
this is love it.
Okay. Yeah. So my boss at this company, he would be so mad at me he's such a humble guy. And like, you can never talk about individuals when you talk about this company, which was really funny because here are these right-leaning guys, but the compensation was based on teamwork. There was no reason to ever stab your friend in the back or try to get a sale because everyone was sharing the loot. I was loving this company, but we had a tremendous scandal. To make a long story short, something happened where when these farmers would make trades, we would give the money to another company to clear the trade. If you lost money, made money, they'd separate it all and send it back. There was a guy named John Corzine, who was the governor of New Jersey, who ran this company. And to make a long story short, he took our farmers' money and he bet it on Italian debt. And he lost it. It was horrific. So it was a real scandal. And I watched my boss spring into action, and we had to communicate with all of our clients every day, and he had to write them an email and I would help him with it. And I noticed that every day he would write just the truth. He would just say, look, this is what we know. This is what we don't know. Whatever you heard in CNBC or New York Times or Wall Street Journal, we can't be sure of that. We can only be sure of what the government is saying, who's overseeing this incident. So anyway, I learned a tremendous amount from him about handling pressure. He didn't yell at anybody. He didn't take it out on anyone. If anything, his attitude was, we've had an amazing run. We're due for trouble.
Right.
And I watched him stick to his core principles for conducting himself and for how to handle this kind of thing. And he actually made me a much better writer. Watching him cut to the bone, I mean, sometimes we'd send out an email. I'd write all this flowery stuff, you know, please do not be worried. And he was like, bullshit, this is a time to be worried. And he would sometimes write, dear clients, today we have nothing to tell you because nothing happened. Thank you. And I was like, oh my God. And our clients absolutely loved us. Like the eventually, thank God, they got their money back and they saw that we were really good guys. But by watching the way we treated our farmers, who were taught basic principles of risk management, very unsexy, just do follow these rules and you'll make money. And I met so many farmers, great guys. I met a farmer in Jerome, Idaho, and a dairy farmer in Defiance, Ohio. I met hog farmers in Missouri. And I saw the same thing from these guys again and again and again. They would say something like this: I had a cow, I got milk out of her, I sold it, I made money, I got two cows, and now I have 60,000 cows, and you see like how rich these guys are, but they're very humble. So anyway, that was a long-winded way of saying I wanted to mix that with what I learned from the martial arts, which is also based on principles.
And discipline.
Exactly. Principles and discipline. And for my writing school, I just wrote a little book that was going to be the basis of my school. And I collected all my principles, and I was building up my school. And then one day, I thought I would self-publish, but I decided, learning what I learned about marketing, I was like, this is not going to be easy to get the word out on my own. I mean, it's hard enough to write this book. So a friend of mine wrote a really successful book called The Personal MBA. His name's Josh Kaufman. He's a great guy. I cannot recommend that book enough. And he I knew that he loved his agent. So without even asking him, I sent that agent an email just saying, hey, is there any chance you'd read my little book just to see if there might be anything here? And I got like the luckiest break in the world. She just completely got it. She signed me right away. And I know it's really true that I think if I had written that book telling everyone and their mother and my wife, I was going to, this book was going to be huge. It's going to be a massive bestseller. I would never have sold it. I just don't think I would have. So she,
because that wasn't your intention.
Right. It was an honest effort to just share basic, unpretentious, unaffected principles. And a lot of books about story, they're great, but they're very formulaic. They're just this, you know, on page 10, you do this. On page 30, you do this. And I was like, ugh.
It's like the whole structure is repeated over and over again.
It's a jar. Yeah. And I didn't want to build a cookie cutter type of thing. So that book, but I can't even tell you. And then from the farmers and from my old friend and boss, he always taught me that everything takes much longer than you think it will. You should always add like a year. So from the time my agent signed me, and I didn't know this, but for all you aspiring authors out there, I had written a draft of the book, but you don't sell a book. You sell a book proposal. So you have to write a 70 or like 60 page proposal saying, who are you? Who cares who you are? What the hell do you know about this subject? Who says you're any good? And that took like 6 months to write the proposal. Then it took us about 9 months to sell the book.
Oh my goodness.
But I did have to quit my job and risk it all again. Luckily, I have an amazing wife who was like, yeah, it's time. I think because my energy was right, my wife was ready to say, all right, it's time to go for this again. And also, she's, to be honest, successful executive. So that was helpful. I recommend that so highly to young people that I meet. I didn't plan on doing that, but marrying well, actually, my parents were right. That's like a
good thing. Nothing wrong with that.
Yes, it turned out to be really helpful.
So wait, how did your people take it at your marketing job?
That's a great question. I actually, because, again, this is so corny, but it's so true. You know, you always see this practice, have an attitude of gratitude. And because I really loved these guys, and because I massively respected them, I went to them and I said, look, I can't work full-time and write a book. There's just no way. And we made a deal where I went part-time. And so I couldn't believe I was going to do like, I was like, wow, I can make some money and write the book. And I did that for like a year and a half, 2 years. And then I realized like, nah, this has to be full-time. Like writing a book is, I'm actually finishing up as we speak. And it's so hard and it's so consuming. Mm-hmm. So I that's how I eased my way out of that job, but it was always with an attitude of thank you guys so much. And we found a win-win. And then when the time was right, I helped easily transition the person to take my job.
Fantastic.
Yeah. So that was good.
That's awesome.
Thank you.
So now you have, I'm going to get this right. Sure. It is the 27 essential principles of a story.
Yes.
A writer's guide to the greatest stories ever told from Shakespeare to South Park.
Right.
That's
the working title. It's funny. I the book is getting a little heavy. Right now I'm at the tail end of it. And I just pitched to my editor. I said, I think it should be the 21 principles. And I think they're like, no, it's going to be all 27. So I'm actually finishing it up this month. It's due September 1st. But the bottom line with the book is people who know story, who've tried to write screenplays, have heard all these terms. There's all this jargon. Plot twists, inciting incident, crisis, climax, resolution. There's all these words that they're not exactly clear what they mean. And you gotta, so my book is super plain English. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm a New Yorker all the way and I'm a Brooklyn guy, but I like to think this Midwestern plain spoken farmer stuff has gotten in me a little bit. So like the principles in my book are like literally as simple as provoke dilemma. Like you want to watch a character who has a horrible dilemma,
right?
You know, who's going to work and he sees a woman hit by a bus and then he has to decide, should I help this woman or go to work? Like, that's not a choice. You should help the woman. You know, we want to see, like, I don't know if you remember, there's that horrible movie. Horrible in a tragic way, not value judgment way, but like Sophie's Choice. We're like,
sure.
Yeah. I mean, like those kind of choices. Sort of mission that I'm on is to ultra simplify the process without dumbing it down. That's my big thing, that here are these principles, use them any way you see fit to, but it's all about authenticity and using the principles to tell the truth of your experience. So how you and I might struggle through a dilemma might be different. I mean, you just might have a little bit of different, like a guy gets to a car crash and he can only save one person from the, how does he decide? You know, what is he looking for? Right. And then you find out who that guy is, and it's hard, but it's so, but that's the essence of my book, is how do you use these principles to figure out how you, who you are?
Right.
That's the exciting thing about it. And it's very inspired by the martial art thing. So, you know, back to this theme, which I love about the podcast, is it really, really is true. Like, don't get me wrong. If I could go back 20 years and get everything right without having to go through 20 years of learning, I'd go back to...
You wouldn't have been able to do it. I'm going to tell you that right here, right now. So I'm... Right. The one thing, one of the things that I love about your story is all the way back to your roots.
Right.
It's the complete dichotomy about between your parents, you know, complete opposite ends, right, in their desires and what their vision of their own lives should be. And right. Thankfully, for them being bold and courageous enough, they parted so that they could both have that and found it successfully.
Right.
You know, you went down your road, even with Stony Brook. Stony Brook, you had a minute there. You realized, no, this isn't the right path. And you knew better, so you got yourself into the right environment. Brilliant. You know, you hit Steppenwolf. You made your way out to L.A. Yeah, maybe there was arrogance. So you were like, yeah, no, there's bigger and better things for me. But if you had not gone into some of those toxic but yet interesting environments in LA, you could never have known to come back full circle and allow a bunch of Midwestern men with completely different politics and viewpoints from you shape you and bring you back into this place where there's integrity and there's kindness and there are like rules, like meaning good life tenets that would take you to the next place and allow everyone to have a piece of it and participate and understand it. Like every bit of the book and where you are in your life personally has everything to do with that whole dance, like every bit of it, you know? So I think you did get it right. I think your road traveled was amazing, you know?
I think you're right. I mean, you know, it's funny because so much of what I've worked on is, and the smartest people I know, and a lot of the most successful, they love the process. They don't get too rattled when things are not working out. And they don't focus on just the result. Like, I really do think that this is funny to say, maybe psychologists will have a beef with me about this, but like, I really do feel that, and we have such a win at all costs culture, but I really think that one of the things I loved about the black belts at my school, and there was very few of them. I mean, tons and tons of people go through that school and only a few make it that far. But the black belts taught me that you're a black belt more because of what you let go. And so you see them, they're doing the same moves as white belts. They're just not insecure. They don't care what anyone thinks about them. There's not a microscopic doubt in their mind of the purpose of what they're doing.
They're just surrendering.
And they talk about it. They're already dead is what they're like, we're dead. We're not making it out of this universe, right? At least this version of it. Alive.
Right.
So by making peace with that, there's a big freedom. And I do think I've worked my living ass off to get to the point where, although it's funny, I forget this lesson. Like, I just forgot it like an hour before you called.
Okay.
But like being in this place where you have to realize at some point you have to go, it's possible this book will suck. Even though I've worked 3 years on it. I mean, maybe this is too critical and Brooklyn Jewy of me. I mean, we're critical people, my peeps from right. Brooklyn. And I do think like at some point I've had to say, look, I've done the best I could. I know this is an authentic book, but it's going to be what it's going to be. And it's my okay. Staying up until 4 a.m. is not going to make it. So yeah. So that freedom I've learned from the martial art guys and the other guy at his thing is just literally one step at a time. The joke is, I don't know if you're a football fan, but get 3 yards and don't fumble.
That's
if
it.
If you just work the field.
That's right.
Move it slowly up. And it's funny because there's a lot of guys like, why aren't we making more money? We could be doing this deal and we could be doing this thing. And many times I'd see my boss get an offer that looked like it could be good money in the short term. And he'd say, that's not what we do.
Right.
That's not who we are. Right. So you're, it's funny, you know, you helped me realize something that I never even thought of, but I'm 50 now, 51, and my parents, you know, are getting up there. I mean, they're around 80. And I do realize that I don't know if I've ever given them the proper credit for making those changes. I mean, those are not easy changes.
Not especially during that point in time, right? The 70s, 80s, whatever it was, because it must have been back during that.
Sure. Yeah.
Even though it was starting to become more, you know, regular in some ways, especially in New York. I mean, I grew up on the islands. I'm in Queens, so I hear that.
Yeah.
My parents didn't separate early enough. They waited so darn long that they dumped all their poop on us, to be honest with you. But but that was a huge act of courage on the part of your parents and just a desire to want more, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really taught you something, so.
Both their changes lasted. My dad stayed a lawyer until he retired. My mom, sadly, my stepdad just passed away, but she was with him 37 happy years of marriage. And I think it worked out for the best for everyone. So that's my little message of hope to everyone listening to this podcast.
Right?
It really is true that these dark, horrible, challenging moments, they really usually are growth that you see in hindsight. You know, I think Steve Jobs had a famous commencement speech where he said, you can't connect the dots until after you've done it. Then you can go, you know, like he dropped
out. You kind of create the dots in order to connect them. Yeah.
Like he once took a calligraphy class and it was like, why the hell did he do that? And then that became like the typeface he used. It taught him about the typeface that was instrumental in making the Mac. So, that was my little journey with that.
It's the collective. I'm a huge believer in that. That's why I feel like everyone has a story because we're constantly living and things are constantly happening, like it or not. You know, it's that collection of experiences that do shape you. If you are willing to look at it and see what you can get out of something, good or bad, you know, and take it away and let it continue to shape you, that's kind of the whole point, which is why when you said, you know, this book could suck, sure, maybe for some people, I think a lot of people, quite frankly, you know, maybe I'm a little bit, you know, biased here, but I think many people are going to get a tremendous amount of learning and good experience from the book. But I mean, the podcast is the same thing for me. It's like, I decided I don't want to look at data and downloads and I'm not interested in that part of it. I want to just do the work and I want to just have the conversations and I want to keep sharing people's stories as much as I can. And I hope a lot of people tune in, but my measure of success is not going to be based on, you know, the numbers behind the scenes. I don't want to focus on that. So.
Right. And yeah, there's no doubt about it. I have studied this a bit and like, you know, for me, you know, if you have like 500 dedicated followers who really love what you're doing and get it and log on and that's like that's not a ton by today's standards. You know, some people have to have whatever, 500 million or 50 million or whatever the hell, if you're M&M or something, but it's like.
But are you trying to be that? I mean, do you really, is that what you're, you know?
No, I think for me, 100%. I mean, like if I had, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, but like I've taught a bunch of classes at my studio before I put it on hold to write my book. And I have some young writers who I just love to death, who have made massive progress. And I'm rooting so hard for them. But like, I don't know if I had 10 of them who like did an amazing job and who visit me when I'm old and say I helped shape their career. That'd be like amazing. There's a Hebrew expression that I love that is, he who saves one person saves the world. And it's such a great expression because it really talks to how important the individual is.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think realigning I much, much rather have small and high quality than big and vapid or big. And I don't need people fawning all over me. I mean, I wouldn't actually, no, that'd be pretty great. I want massive fawning.
But you don't want to dilute it. I think that's the whole point here. You don't want it to be some diluted piece of something that you really don't feel proud of. I think you're right. I think
Right.
Richer on a smaller scale is going to make a greater impact.
Yes, let's absolutely.
So the book is coming in in the spring of 2020. Yes,
about 2020 probably.
September is the deadline for you to get your stuff in, but then the spring is the actual release. You know, we're revisiting and we're going to re-record for that.
That'd be great.
It's going to be a huge moment.
So I finish it in September 1st.
I think that's good. And I think that, well, you know, I want to make sure that we include, and I'll put this, don't worry about it, I'll put it in the show notes in writing too, but we want to tell the listeners where they can find you. So social feeds, website handle, this and that.
Sure. I have a website, which is my big long name, which is DanielJoshuaRubin.com. And I'm on Twitter. I'm tweeting away. I'm getting up there. As of this moment, I have 160 followers, which I'm like, I got to get in. I got to figure out how that's so, how to say more witty, quick things. I'm pouring my heart out on there, but,
We'll boost you with the show.
Okay, that'd be great. And then I started writing articles for Medium. You know, that was kind of cool. They're trying to build a social network that's more.
And you're found on Medium under your full name also?
I think that one is all. Yeah, I think that's Daniel Joshua Rubin. I should know these things, but that, yeah, I'm sure Daniel Joshua Rubin will find it. And but you know, I did want to say one more thing.
Please.
I don't know if this is too late to talk about, but I think one of the things I'm really excited about story is that, and this book on story and the principles about it is, and it's made watching movies and plays and reading novels so much more enjoyable, is I do think the thing I was saying before is really important, that by studying story and by looking at characters struggle through problems, you really do figure out who you are. And the one I maybe it's a good place to wrap up on, but it's my favorite principle. And it's that life is absolutely not gonna give you what you expect.
What you expect,
And the most essential principle of writing and story, I think, is that and it's really fun when you do this as a writer, is you say to, another great expression is, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. I think that's Woody Allen. And you create a character and you give him or her an expectation, and they're moving through life, and then something unbelievable happens to them, something way out of the ordinary, something they never would have expected in a million years. And when that happens, when you clash what you expected life to bring versus the reality you find yourself in, that is like a twilight zone. You are in a different reality than you ever, I was, you know, in my little journey was, wow, I'm visiting hog farmers and recording testimonial video in a rural town in Missouri that I never dreamed I'd be on. But that is when you really find out who you are. That's the only way. I mean, if life just gives you what you expect, you don't really have a big chance to grow.
So no, there's no comparing and contrasting. And you know what that is? It's called Dreams and Detours.
Dreams and Detours. Perfect place to wrap it up.
It's a wrap.
Thanks a lot.
Yay. That's it for this episode of Dreams and Detours. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe, and share it with your friends. You can find me at dreamsdetours.com and at dreamsdetours on Instagram. Thanks for listening.